Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, and welcome to another enticing episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. On today's podcast, we have a very, very honest interview with Sean Graney, the director of Angels in America and artistic director of the Hypocrites Theater. We also have four very good reviews from Chicago critic Tom Williams, and of course, as always, the theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready for a very honest podcast. Hello, and welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Now let's talk some theater news. Actor Harold Gould is in town starring in the hit Broadway play Tuesdays with Maury. The play, directed by Michael Montel, is patterned after the book Tuesdays with Maury, which became a major hit when it was first published in 1997. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 205 weeks. Tuesdays with Maury is the conversational telling of the relationship between award-winning sports writer Mitch Albom and his former sociology professor, Maury Schwartz, who has been stricken with ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Harold Gould stars as the professor, and the play runs through March 12th at the Cadillac Palace Theater. Martin Short will make an extra stop prior to coming to Chicago. It has been announced that the show will now play Toronto's Cannon Theatre from May 27th to July 2nd, before it comes to Chicago's LaSalle Bank Theatre on July 5th. Fame Becomes Me is a fractured autobiography, searing show business expose, and heart-rending confessional, climaxing in a giant metaphorical snowball. Actor, director, producer, and Steppenwolf Theater founder Gary Sinise will be embarking on his 17th USO tour to provide morale to boost the Marines, sailors, and their family members on March 12th. The performance will take place at the Marine Corps Air Ground Combat Center, the MCA GCC. The trip, sponsored by TriWest Healthcare Alliance, will feature Sinise and the Lieutenant Dan Band. Best known for his Oscar-nominated performance as Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, he is currently starring in the hit new series CSI New York on CBS. Emerald City Theater Company, Chicago's largest professional theater devoted entirely to families, has announced a full slate of five family favorites for its 2006-2007 season. Starting this fall with the newly pared-down version of Seussical and ending next spring with Narnia, Emerald City's 06 and 07 lineup promises innovative, affordable live theater experiences that inspire children and bring families closer together. The season will begin in September with the play Seussical, followed up in November by A Nutcracker Christmas. Then coming in January of 2007, Stinky Cheese Man and Other Fairly Stupid Tales, followed by Snow White in February and ending with Narnia in April. For more information, visit TheaterInChicago.com or visit www.EmeraldCityTheater.org. The Steppenwolf Theater Company has announced its own blog. Visit blog.steppenwolf.org for some behind-the-scenes look on theater matters and non-theater entries. And also some other news from Steppenwolf Theater. Bruce Norris's The Pain and the Itch and Adam Rapp's Red Light Winter, both of which had premiered at Steppenwolf, are two of the six finalists for the American Theater Critics Association New Play Awards. The award offers $25,000 to the winning playwright. Skokie's Northlight Theatre has announced that it will kick off its 2006-2007 season with a revival of Inherit the Wind, the very popular play about the 1925 Scopes Monkey Trial. Jessica Thebus will direct the drama about when a small-town Tennessee teacher was put on trial for lecturing about Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. The remainder of Northlight's season includes Bad Dates, Teresa Rabick's comedy about a single mother breaking into the Manhattan dating scene, Lady, another world premiere by Craig Wright, She Stoops to Conquer, the classic comedy by Oliver Goldsmith, and Fire on the Mountain, a new musical about the lives of coal miners in Appalachia. For more information, go to TalkTheaterInChicago.com's Theater News section. I'm Dustin Moat. This has been Talk Theater in Chicago's News Podcast.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here is my review of Thoroughly Modern Millie at Marriott Theater. Book by Richard Morris and Dick Scanlon. New music by Janine Tesori with new lyrics by Dick Scanlon. Directed and choreographed by Mark Robin. Marriott Theatre's energetic Millie produces laughs and bounces throughout. How do you improve on a show that won 6 Tony Awards? Answer: have Mark Robin direct and choreograph with the slick, polished production team from the Marriott Theatre in Lincolnshire. Together with an ensemble of A-list actors, you can't go wrong. Thoroughly Modern Millie is a fun show filled with outstanding dancing, energetic performances with loads of laughs. Considered as one of the lightest musicals ever to win a Tony Award for Best Musical, Millie delights us with 2.5 hours of songs, dances, and more laughs than anyone could anticipate. Many folks who saw the Broadway production liked the Marriott Theatre's production much better due to the fabulous craftsmanship of Mark Robin and the Marriott crew. This show is big, bubbling, and bright. Thoroughly Modern Millie boasts a fine score by Janine Tesori and Dick Scanlon that echoes the sounds of the 1920s jazz era. Based on the 1967 Oscar-winning film Thoroughly Modern Millie, Millie takes audiences back to the heights of the jazz age in the 1920s when moderns, including a flapper named Millie Dilmont, in a delightful turn by Tara Kelly, were bobbing their hair, raising their hemlines, entering the workforce, and rewriting the rules of love. This is kind of the first of the modern feminist shows. Millie takes New York with her razzmatazzing in a bold, bright, old-fashioned Broadway musical that is so much fun that we simply lay back and soak up all the cute fluff. This is a no-brain show that is just pure entertainment. The recognizable Thoroughly Modern Millie song, which is written by Sammy Kahn and James Van Heusen, is nicely presented and used to underscore and enhance the new songs by Tesori and Scanlon. From the terrific opening number of Not For the Life of Me, that Tara Kelly, who plays Millie, nailed to the cross. This was a very, very strong number. To the clever zany speed test number, where we see people dancing in the same rhythms as people pounding on a typewriter, which was a very, very cute part. The speed test number is done in such an exaggerated operatic style that the number is really a parody and an ode to the old Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald musical films, those old operettas, those really hokey ones. Also, Millie nailed her haunting love song, Jimmy. The 19-song score features many show-stopping dance numbers that feature outstanding tap, jazz, and clever satirical dances that Mark Robin has created to give depth to the story, as well as offering breathtaking entertainment. Millie is an underrated dance show that features refreshing takes on the 1920s dance styles like the jitterbug and the Charleston. I love the slick Mark Robin choreography and the talented hoofers that he has assembled for this show. Tara Kelly gave Millie a strong vocal as well as a cute Carol Burnett persona that easily wins our hearts. She is so lovable in this role, and she was better than anyone I've seen in the tour. And friends of mine who saw the original Broadway production think that Tara Kelly is as good, if not better, a Millie as anyone who's played the role. Tara Kelly's Jimmy and Gimme Gimme songs light the torch with haunting emotions, and her Forget the Boys number with the tapping girls demonstrates Kelly as a triple threat performer. Stephen Shellhart, with fine vocal range and sincere acting, as well as an outstanding dance talent, is a likable Jimmy Smith, who is the love interest for Millie. E. Faye Butler belts out several songs in the best Dorothy Dandridge tradition, while Rosalind Ron Kearns is a hoot as the Oriental imitator, the white slaver, Mrs. Mears. Kearns steals several scenes with her Mukwin song with Darren Wag and Imar Janzen, who bring down the house. This is where they're singing, and the language is they're talking Chinese, and then they have the captions above. This is a really cute thing. It's also a parody on the old Charlie Chan movies of the 1920s. Thoroughly Modern Millie is a light show that sings well, dances superbly, and garners enough laughs to make it a pleasant show that will thoroughly entertain you. I was surprised at how well Mark Robin was able to milk the laughs and give his actors an opportunity to play it bigger than life just to make sure everyone really laughed. I mean, I have not seen a production of Millie that got us laughing as much as this one. And of course, the choreography was fabulous. The mark of a Marriott Theater show in the capable hands of directors such as Mark Robin is the swift pace, terrific costuming with vivid lighting, and a lively, outstanding orchestra that actually makes the score even bouncier. I especially enjoyed Brian Herriot's stiff take on the stuffy Trevor Graydon and the clever dances that were in this show. Millie is a fine spoof of all those old MGM film musicals set in the 1920s. This show is pure joy. A lot of people were reluctant to see Thoroughly Modern Millie because they thought it was an overblown puff piece when it came through here on tour. And I guess an argument could be made for that. But in the hands of the Marriott Theater's quality control and on the intimate, in-the-round staging, Millie has such high energy. And Robin got everyone playing it for the laughs that you just laugh and you just, it's a tearjerker in the sense that you laugh so hard that you get tears in your eyes. My rating for this show, highly recommended. Thoroughly Modern Millie at the Marriott Theater in Lincolnshire, Milwaukee Avenue and Route 22 in Lincolnshire. The schedule is Wednesdays at 1 and 8, Thursdays at 8, Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 5 and 8:30, Sundays at 1 and 5. The running time is 2 hours and 30 minutes with intermission. The show runs through April 23rd. The ticket price is $42 to $45. Call 847-634-0200. That's 847-643-0200. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Nina Simone, The High Priestess Speaks, by Ebony Joy, directed by Jackie Taylor and Ebony Joy. Black Ensemble captures the essence of Nina Simone. Black Ensemble Theater's specialty is the bio musical, featuring the lives and music of influential African American artists. Their latest, Nina Simone, The High Priestess Speaks, is a quality, musically rich show that captures the personality and the distinct style of the complex, self-named High Priestess. Nina Simone, born Eunice Wayman, lived from 1933 to 2003. In a terrific performance by Yadina Udine, who nails the unique, diversified musical styles of Simone deftly, playwright Ebony Joy employs first-person narrative to have Nina Simone tell her own story. Yadina Udine was terrific as she captured the essence of Nina Simone, who was an intricate and complicated person. How befitting this strong, determined, and fanatical artist whose fierce independence and political awareness led her to become a key spokeswoman for the Black Power movement of the 1960s. She later on denounced America and lived in Europe. Filled with 18 songs aptly played by Jimmy Tillman's 8-member band, let me just say that Jimmy Tillman, who does conduct the orchestra for Black Ensemble and has for years, always comes up with top arrangements, and the sound is tremendous. They do a great job. But with his renditions, we get a great sampler of the varied styles of the Simone repertory. I had the privilege of seeing Nina Simone in concert in the late 1960s, and I remember her shaming the audience to quiet down before she would sing. Talk about controlling the audience. Simone's uniqueness came from her exaggerated singing style, marked by Bachian counterpoint, deft use of silence, pauses, repeats, even shouts, and vocal variations, with her impeccable timing, all geared to harvest the emotional underlinings of her songs. She was a master of style. She was an accomplished pianist, composer, arranger, and lyricist, equally at home with gospel music, spiritual, jazz, blues, R&B, with sprinkles of classical thrown in, and of course some show tunes. She also utilized such unique things as African chants in some of her performances. Playwright Ebony Joy presents a personal profile that depicts Simone as an intensely driven, fiercely independent, focused performer. With an amazingly rich voice, Yadina Yadin evokes Simone's tone with blues numbers like For Myself, Feeling Good, and Tell Me More and More and Then Some More, and Sugar in My Bowl, which was my personal favorite number of the show. Gospel songs I'll Fly Away, Be My Husband, and Sinner Man were toe-tapping treats. Yadin really nailed Simone's first hit, I Love You Porgy, with a tenderness that reached down into my heart. Once Simone realized her calling was to be a part of the Black movement of empowerment of the 1960s, she penned Mississippi God, a toe-tapping, up-tempo R&B political song designed as a wake-up call to her people. Her Young, Gifted, and Black was a tribute to Lorraine Hansberry, the author of Raisin in the Sun. Several songs were underscored with African-styled and modern dances led by Reuben Eccles and a small ensemble. Too bad there wasn't more of this delightful dance in the shows. That's one thing I think Jackie Taylor needs to add to her shows. She has some terrifically talented dancers with choreography done by Reuben Eccles. I think we should see a little bit more of that in the shows. Jackie Taylor and Ebony Joy give us a glimpse into the magnificent aura that Nina Simone possessed that put a spell on audiences. Nina Simone, The High Priestess Speaks, is an immensely entertaining show filled with vintage Simone songs. My rating for this show? Recommended. It is also a Jeff recommended show. Nina Simone, The High Priestess Speaks at Black Ensemble Theater, 4520 North Beacon, Chicago, Illinois. The schedule is Friday and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 3. The running time is 2 hours with intermission. It's a limited open run. Tickets are $35. You can call 773-769-4451. That's 773-769-4451. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of Tale of the Allergist Wife by Charles Bush, directed by Kurt Johns at Apple Tree Theater in Highland Park. Chicago's finest actors shine in side-splitting comedy. Apple Tree Theater in Highland Park once more offers a cute choice, Charles Bush's wacky boulevard comedy, The Tale of the Allergist Wife. This terrific comedy is part New York shtick, with hints of Woody Allen and Neil Simon. It's also part fable that delivers its smart humor through a host of eccentric characters. I like this show, and so will you. The show boasts four of Chicago's leading performers, Paula Scarfano, John Rieger, Renee Matthews, Hollis Resnick, with fine supporting work from Vashal Patel. Director Kurt Johns brilliantly staged this comedy, utilizing Richard and Jacqueline Penrod's exquisite Upper West Side apartment set that reaches to all three sides of the apple tree's intimate stage. We see four comedy pros deliver the show's rich humor with perfect time jokes, punchlines, rejoiners, and retorts. We meet Marjorie, Paula Scarfano, in a fabulously emotionally draining performance, who is stalled in a midlife crisis that leaves her stuck in a depressed state. She feels emotionally empty as she realizes that all her philanthropic endeavors and cultural efforts have left her feeling as a worthless, mediocre cultural poseur. With her vain but successful retired allergist husband, John Rieger, in a nicely underplayed turn, supports her and loves her. But still, Marjorie wallows in depression. Paula Scarfano demonstrates her emotional range as she cavils from raging neurotic to confident, self-absorbed snob. Renee Matthews, as the foul-mouthed mother of Marjorie, was a hoot as she nailed one zinger after another, as she laments about her bowel movements and exudes her negativity about life and her daughter Marjorie. Renee Matthews is sure the master of the deadpan comedy. Once more, Renee Matthews proves that there is no one like her in Chicago. When Lee, Hollis Resnick, marvelous as usual, a stranger from Marjorie's childhood, mysteriously appears, Marjorie comes to life as the two share New York's cultural scene. Is Lee a phony name-dropper who's constantly telling tales of meeting and influencing world leaders, intellectuals, and pop cultural icons, or is she a mythical figure? Judge for yourself. It fits that she is either. It fits in a sincere way, as many fables do, because in a fable, when a character gets stuck, as Marjorie does, a stranger appears to show the way. If Lee is an angel, she sure is a horny one who seduces both Marjorie and Ira into a menage a trois in a hilarious scene. As the funny play progresses, we start doubting Lee's intentions. Only the wary Frida, again that's Renee Matthews, the mother of Marjorie, suspects Lee's insincerity, but only for a while, because Lee exudes such a large amount of charm that she wins everyone over, even the negative doubting mother. The plot twists work, and the resolution finds only Marjorie changed, as the vague ending leaves open questions. That may be one of the weaker parts of the show, but I think it worked, because I think it is a fable, and I think the Lee character is part Gollum and part angel. But then that's me, and it's just as valid to say that she's just a name-dropping phony who was out to hustle out of some money and get a free place to stay. But either way, it's a very funny show. The Tale of the Allergist Wife is a well-written social satire full of parody. It parodies and pokes fun at many pop cultural motifs and beliefs. The outstanding performances from all four leads make this show a treat. You'll laugh and appreciate the depth of talent led by Paula Scarfano, who once more demonstrates why she is Chicago's most talented all-around leading lady. My rating for The Tale of the Allergist Wife, recommended. The show is at Apple Tree Theater, which is 595 Elm Place in Highland Park. Tickets are $35 to $45. The schedule for the show is Wednesdays and Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 5 and 8:30, Sundays at 3. The running time is 2 hours 10 minutes with intermission. The show runs through March 19th. Call 847-432-4335. That's 847-432-4335. Thank you. I'll see you next time. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here is my review of Private Lives by Noel Coward at First Folio Shakespeare Festival. Coward's masterpiece marvelously comes alive in this stellar production. First Folio Shakespeare Festival, under the dedicated leadership of David Rice and Allison Vesely, have mounted an exemplar body of theatrical work over the years, making the trip to the western suburbs worthwhile. Their latest, Private Lives, is a terrific production, combining outstanding work from four actors with Noel Coward's sophisticated wit, fluid language, and smart, quirky plot. It amounts to an intelligent, hilarious night of the theater. You'll laugh as you acknowledge the utter honesty of Noel Coward's words. There is not a misplaced syllable, comma, or word in the script. The play demonstrates Coward's keen observation of human nature. We meet two rich society couples, each honeymooning on the French Riviera. Elliot Chase, played marvelously by Joseph Wyckoff, is a sharp, smart, and in-tune, high-society British gentleman. His new bride, Louise, is a slender, vibrant Leia Wagner. They are enjoying the view from their room, but Louise can't stop asking Elliot about his former marriage. This irritates the smug Elliot. Coward deliciously sets up the entire plot with this scene. This is a craftsman at work and two terrific actors that really set the tone. You instantly like them and you're now engaged in the play and you're laughing at the smart, witty dialogue. When the couple returns to their room, we meet another couple who emerge from the next door balcony. The two rooms share one balcony, and that's what the set looks like, and it's supposed to be the French Riviera. So the next group to come out, it's Amanda, who is played in a marvelous performance by Melanie Keller. She is just delicious. Amanda, ironically, is Elliot's ex, with her new husband, Victor, played by Christian Grey as a stiff, pompous English gentleman, who proceeds to interrogate Amanda also about her first husband. Coward's wit and smart plotting emerge with these scenes. We see sort of a parallel, and you start getting an idea of where this thing is going. Again, it's done with such droll wit that you'll enjoy it. So when Elliot and Amanda eventually meet each other alone on the balcony, Elliot comes out to get a breath of air, and Amanda's out there. And the scene when the two of them face each other for the first time, and they were married 3 years, and they were separated for five. So they've had sort of an eight-year on-and-off love affair. As soon as they see one another, the sparks begin to fly. The astute pacing and marvelous expressive exchanges masked by the dialogue allow Joseph Wyckoff and Melanie Keller to reminisce in a wonderful and telling scene. This is some great nonverbal acting. And of course, they add Noel Coward's fabulous dialogue to it. The chemistry between these two was genuine and electrifying. This instant rekindling produced a deep-seated love, propelled the two to desire to run away together. Problem: they are both newly married to someone else, and they're both on their honeymoon. The clever dark comedy aptly and hilariously presents a maddening love affair that allows a couple to flee from society's rules, but not from their own private lives. In the hands of the master wit, Private Lives unfolds as one of the cleverest plays written in the 20th century, as it presents the foibles of human nature, sexual wants, and society's rules in conflict. The truth of Coward's words added depth to the humor. Often the truth bites us deeply. You'll be impressed with the fabulous acting by this stellar cast, whose excellent high British accents, proper posture, and manners are wonderfully articulate Noel Coward's stinging dialogue with impeccable comedic timing by the four actors and appropriate gestures and facial expressions. Christian Grey, Leia Wagner were excellent, but the play hinges on Melanie Keller's Amanda and Joseph Wyckoff's Elliot. These two landed their roles as the irascible characters with deft aplomb. This is a sharp ensemble work that exudes its wit and humor magnificently. Private Lives reminds us just how intelligent Noel Coward was as a playwright. It also is a great example of the fine, detailed work that First Folio Shakespeare Festival does. This is worth the ride out to Oakbrook to see the show. I very, very much enjoyed it. I think Noel Coward would tip his hat and pour a drink to the four actors and to the terrific production. My rating for this show, highly recommended. The show is Private Lives, produced by First Folio Shakespeare Festival at Mays Lake Peabody Estate, which is 31st Street and Route 83 in Oak Brook. The show runs Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 3. The running time is 2 hours and 25 minutes with intermission. The show runs through March 19th. The ticket price is $25, which is a bargain for an equity show of this caliber. Get tickets by calling 630-986-8067. That's 630-986-8067. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest for today is Sean Graney, who is the founding member and artistic director of the Hypocrites Theater Company here in Chicago. The Hypocrites Theater Company is, in this reporter's view, one of the three finest non-equity theater companies in Chicago. Graney founded the Hypocrites in 1997, and it is dedicated to theater of honesty. It is a performance and presentation-based theater company that demands emotional honesty from its actors and uses high theatricality in all its performances. The goal of the Hypocrites is to connect the artist and the audience, while pushing the limits and honoring the playwright's intentions. Let me read a quote that says a lot about our guest, Sean Graney. Quote, "I think the playwright is a slave to the art, so the playwright knocks out his or her ego to create universal, long-standing art. Then the director needs to be a slave to the playwright. Everything you do as a director needs to come from what the playwright wants. The actors and designers are then slaves to the director. I demand of actors a complete mental and physical commitment to the role, and it always goes back to the playwright." Hello, Sean.
Hello, how's it going?
Great. So now, based on that quote, does that mean that you are a playwright's director?
I don't know if you could call me necessarily a playwright's director. I definitely think that the chain for a theatrical event starts with the playwright, and it's definitely important to figure out what the playwright was attempting to communicate subconsciously with their play. And once you figure that out, I think then the director has to learn how to effectively communicate that to an audience through designers and actors.
Well, that's great. Now, we are here at Bailiwick Repertory doing this interview, and you are doing a joint production with your Hypocrites group and Bailiwick with Angels in America, the play that I consider to be the finest play of the 20th century.
Wow, that's a huge statement, the finest play of the 20th century. Certainly is a great, great, great play.
Right. Why Angels and why now?
We have had some success with American plays within the last couple of seasons, so we're trying to focus a little bit more on them. And this play just seemed very obvious. It's a classic, a contemporary classic of the American theater.
Well, you know, I know a lot of people that have seen Angels several times, as I have, and they're looking forward to seeing it because you are directing it. You know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but you're on that list now. The Hypocrites as a theater company is on that list. If they're doing a play, go see it. And by the way, you may or may not ask what the play is. They know the quality control of what Hypocrites has done. And the same with you. If your name's on it, they'll go see it.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I'm not sure how true that is, but thank you very much.
No, it is true. I you know, among critics, like when you did Death of a Salesman, which I still think is one of the great productions that I've seen. Many people were curious, and they said, you know, they've seen it so many times. The only reason they went to see this is because you directed it. They wanted to see what your take would be on it.
Well, that's very nice. People are very nice to me. So.
And it did get critical acclaim, didn't it? I mean, we all liked it.
It was very well received. People were very complimentary to me and the production. So I'm very thankful.
Okay, who is in Angels now? And tell us, are you reinterpreting it at all? Or what's your approach? Tell us what your approach is for that.
Well, I never reinterpret, like, even with those plays that you mentioned, like The Glass Menagerie or Death of a Salesman, it's not about reinterpretation. It's about individualistic interpretation, personal interpretation. It's not about what can I do that is going to be different from all these other productions of the play. It's about what can I do that'll express what I want to with this play. You know, never betraying what the playwright wants to, but what can I express with this play? So through that, I come up with a very personal interpretation. Stylistically, I have a very personal way that I approach things, and I don't think of it in terms of a sort of a theatrical style that I'm trying to force onto a script.
Okay. Well, I noticed with Death of a Salesman, you did the set design too.
I co-designed the set with Jim Moore. Yep.
And I know that you had all of the doors. You had doors going all the way around it. That was quite symbolic. And other touches you had. The one most notable was when Willie talks about the man in Boston, his mentor, mm-hmm. and how he did more sales with the green slippers. And then right at the key scene near the end, he puts on the green slippers.
Yeah.
I mean, that was such a terrific touch.
Well, thanks. Thanks. I appreciate that. It's it was weird with Death of a Salesman, because that's in the script it says that Willie runs off stage, and I just thought it was very strange, you know, not arguing with Arthur Miller, and I'm not even sure who wrote those stage directions for the script of Death of a Salesman, but I thought it was strange to have a protagonist that you spend, you know, almost 3 hours with not be present for the climax, not be present for the sort of titular event of what the play has been driving for. Like, you're with this guy and you care about this guy and all his faults and all his dreams being shattered and destroyed around him, and then all of a sudden he leaves and you're supposed to sort of emotionally still be there for the climax. And I just found that really strange. So once I sort of figured out that he could be there for that climax, he could be there for the actual event of his death, that sort of opened up a whole other series of doors for what that meant and what that could mean.
And it worked rather well. It really did.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So, with Angels in America, are there any, what's your approach to that now? What can we expect on Sunday, March 5th, when it opens?
Well, to be honest, I've been concentrating on the story. The story is so huge. It's just, you know, just focusing on the first part of it, Millennium Approaches right now, and later we'll focus more on Perestroika, but it's just telling the story. The story is so complicated, so huge. It's in and out of different people's lives. People show up on stage, these wonderful, complicated characters show up on stage, they have their own story, and they're only in a scene, and then they're gone. So just really trying to figure out what the story is that we're communicating with this play.
Who's going to be in the play I assume you're using some of the people from your ensemble, because you have a really talented group of actors.
Oh, thanks. Kurt Ehrman is in the play, Steve Wilson. These are all company members. Kurt Ehrman, Steve Wilson, Michelle Moe, Donna McGuff, Jennifer Grace. And then we have J.B. Waterman, who's not in the company, and Cliff London and Scott Bradley.
Boy, that's a good group. I just love Michelle Moe. I think she is one of the best actors in town.
I agree with you. I'm just so lucky to have known her and been able to work with her for so long, and she has taught me a lot as a director just working with her. So
who are playing? Tell us who are playing a couple of the key roles, because a lot of people know the characters.
Right. Pryor, who is played by this gentleman, Scott Bradley, who he moved here from D.C. recently, probably about a year ago.
Yes, I have seen him. He's very talented.
Oh, he's great. He's great. Really pleasure to work with. And Kurt Ehrman is playing Roy Cohn. Stephen Wilson's playing Lewis. Michelle is playing Harper.
Oh, Michelle, I had to be. I guessed that, but I wanted you to say that. And And that's one of the key roles in the whole play.
It's a really fun, interesting role, and I think she's doing a great job with it. So,
well, that's good. So tell us about your process now of putting a play like this together.
Well, we started rehearsing probably at the beginning of December.
Wow, that's going bad.
Yeah, well, we have, because we're opening Millennium Approaches, and then 4 weeks after that, we're opening Perestroika, and running Perestroika for a week, and then we're running them in rep for the following 3 weeks, I believe. And the time between Millennium Approaches and Perestroika opening is very... It seemed like a long time when we were planning it, but actually when I start down to in the summer to make the put the schedule together, it was like realizing we only had like 7 rehearsals for Perestroika after Millennium Approaches. So we pretty much had to get both shows blocked out and in pretty good shape, and then we concentrated on Millennium Approaches for the past 2 weeks.
And how often, since it's your non-equity, you don't do daytime rehearsals because a lot of people have a day job. How long are the rehearsals, and you know how many days in a week? If an actor was in a Sean Graney show, how hard do you work them?
Well, they get worked pretty hard for different, and it depends on the show how hard they work, in which ways they work. But generally, we go about 4 hours of rehearsal period, Monday through Wednesday or Monday through Thursday, and then Saturday and Sunday mornings.
Okay, well, I can't wait to see Angels in America.
Oh, thanks.
Because I know, I mean, it's such a great play, and I know that you will get everything out of it. Some people say your average shows, if there is such a thing, are other people's masterpieces.
Oh,
but
that's really sweet. I'm just not so sure that's true, but I appreciate that.
Sorry, I want to put you on the spot. But now let's talk about Sean Greeny and your background. I read in doing some research that you considered yourself a misfit.
Yeah, I still consider myself a misfit. I was... You mean as far as I get into theater? Probably.
Yes. Let's talk about how you got in theater, and you're from the Boston area, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I'm from about 20 minutes north of Boston, a town called Saugus, Massachusetts, the suburbs. And I didn't play sports, so me and my friend needed something to do after school, so we started a drama club at the high school.
You started the drama club. That's cool.
Yeah, they had done plays, but we sort of organized it, and... got this really nice woman who directed plays at the church to be involved. And we sort of started the drama club, which I recently heard has closed its doors.
Oh, that's terrible.
Oh, yeah. Well, whatever, you know.
But then you went to college and you wanted to be, what, an artist? Or?
I went to Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts to be an actor. I majored in acting. And probably about my junior year, I started to realize I was a terrible actor, so I stopped acting and I got into playwriting. And then I graduated, was doing plays in Boston area, not really knowing what I'm doing, but Boston at that time in the early 90s was not a very conducive place to young, wasn't a very conducive place to young artists. The reviewers wouldn't come out, and it was basically we were doing plays in basements of bars and our friends and family.
So they don't back storefront theater like they do here, huh?
I've heard it's changed. So this was the early 90s, and it was apparently it's a different time. It's a different place now, so I don't want to badmouth Boston. Right. Just at that time.
That's good politically.
It wasn't very supportive of younger artists. So I wanted to move to a city that... I could do theater in and have people come see it. And I heard about Chicago, and I also heard about Seattle. I was a little intimidated by the price tag of New York. So I was going to visit Chicago and Seattle, and I decided to visit. I visited Chicago first, and I saw Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. And I didn't even visit Seattle because I was like, this is the city I want to be in.
You know, I'm hearing that more and more people are coming in, the kids from the house theater, and so many groups are coming. So you don't regret moving here?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. It's a wonderful city for what... It's a wonderful... I wouldn't have been able to do what I have done here anyplace else.
So you, from what my research showed, that when you moved here, you started working as a house manager for Chicago Shakespeare Theater?
Yeah, I worked in Starbucks for a few years, and then I was drinking a lot. And I stopped.
Well, that makes you a real Chicagoan.
Well, now I don't drink at all. So I was drinking a lot, and it was sort of like I was thinking I was a playwright, but I had no idea what it meant to be a playwright. And so I was writing these really terrible plays. And then one night I was just like, I'm sick of writing these terrible plays, sitting in my room, getting drunk, trying to write plays. It was ridiculous. So I decided to quit Starbucks and get a job, a professional job in theater. And luckily enough, Chicago Repertory, which is now the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, hired me as their house manager for a season. And that, it's the worst job in theater, house management. It's just.
I agree. That is a tough job.
It's a terrible, terrible job. But, I mean, they were so nice. And just talking to the actors, you know what I mean? Hanging around every night, talking to the actors, you know, Chicago standards like Larry Yando and Bob Scoggin and, you know, younger people like Joe Faust and Scott Parkinson. And I was just like meeting these incredible, incredible actors. It sort of taught me what Chicago theater was. And it was just an amazing season, an amazing time in my life. And after I ended that job, I decided to start a theater company because I figured I figured not because of talent, because I looking at all these Chicago theater companies, I realized that like successful theater companies just did lots of shows, and you didn't have to do good ones, you just had to do lots of shows in order to be a successful theater company. So I was like, I could probably do lots of shows.
Yeah. But also, you did good shows.
Well, that's really nice. Thanks. But, you know, it didn't matter, and it still doesn't matter. No offense to anybody. But, like, all you have to do is do a show, like, three shows a year, and you're considered a known successful theater company.
So you're saying the toleration level. Us critics in town, we're not that brutal to knock you out. Huh?
Yeah, it's really a very supportive city. And there's always... You know, of course, everybody struggles for audiences. Everybody does. We do all the time. There's enough of an audience usually, you know, to come see no matter what you do. There'll be somebody out there who will enjoy it.
Well, that's good. And but when you started Hypocrites, what was your idea? I know where you're at now is different than where you were, thank God. I mean, because we all grow as artists. But what was the initial concept you had?
The initial concept I had was that there wasn't exactly... There were a couple companies in town that I really, really admired. But overall, like, there wasn't any of the theater that I really loved and the theatrical experiences that I really, really enjoyed and were inspired by being done here very often.
Was that at that time your interest was more in the absurdist theater?
Yeah, that's what I labeled it as, in the absurdist theater. You know, Ionesco, I continue to be a huge fan of Ionesco. I said that I only liked absurdist theater, you know, or theater that related to the absurdist somehow. But, you know, the more I learn about what the absurdists were doing, it wasn't anything radically new, and it can be reflected in so many other different plays.
So it's kind of after you got the absurdist plays produced, you went through that phase, and then you started moving more into what we would call mainstream plays, or...
Yeah, it's sort of mainstream plays. It's sort of like realizing what, rather than saying, I just like absurdist plays, which is a closed-minded, ridiculous thing to say, but it's, you know, I had said it many times a long time ago. But I asked myself, what do I like about these plays? And I realized once I asked myself these questions about what I like and what these plays do for me, I could find those qualities in vast amounts of other plays.
Interesting concept. Shows the growth, your growth as an artist, too. You use that theater of honesty. Tell us what that means. I mean, that's a great phrase, and it connotates quite a bit, but be a little more specific for us.
Well, I'll start with my love for the absurdist again. I think that they're honest in sort of a very a way that they admit that theater is theater and that there's no dishonesty in the illusion of theater. They don't try to put up a fourth wall and pretend that you're not there and pretend that they're someplace else. I mean, the absurdist root theater in theater, you know, meta-theatrical style, where the theater, it's their plays are about being in a theater, and you need that element of being conscious that you're in a theater to have the plays perpetuate and carry the story along and have it make a lot more sense. So I mean honesty that way, and honesty of presentation. And then honesty in performance, I just mean, like, the actor has to be emotionally connected to their character and has to emotionally understand their character and be emotionally responsible on stage, emotionally available to their character and to the audience, and be willing to share vast amounts of their emotional experience with the audience.
Would you say that you're demanding of your actors to reach that standard, that connection with the audience? Because I agree with you, and your plays come off that way. They really do. It's a good way of defining.
Well, thanks. I do demand a lot of the actors. I really do. And sometimes you can ask many actors. Sometimes I demand too much, and sometimes I'm completely unreasonable. And sometimes they can rise to that, and sometimes it just is beyond any kind of human ability whatsoever. But I do demand a lot of the actors, and I expect a lot of them.
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of actors because I'm one who goes to all the receptions because, you know, I'm a mooch anyhow. But, you know, that they may get mad at you, as they do any directors who are demanding. But, you know, they all have respect and they'd all kill to be in your plays. I mean, you among actors in town that I've talked to, you have a very good reputation. And they all, they say, oh, I'd love to have him cast me in something. And I always kid them, do you know what you're getting into?
I know, they probably don't know what they're getting into. And I find that, you know, I find that, and appreciate the compliment, but I find that a lot where actors are like, oh, I would love to be in your shows or whatever, and then I cast them. And then when I finally do ask them to do things that are out of the norm, but not something that I feel is unreasonable or incomprehensible, they're unwilling to accept that. So I wonder why they wanted to be in one of my plays to begin with. Because, I mean, I feel like you can see one of my plays, and, like, for better or for worse, whatever people's opinions are, it's not realism. It's not American realism, you know, what they're used to. It's not – they're going to have to stretch themselves in certain ways.
Thank God, because the film does that.
Yeah,
television can do that.
Yeah,
we don't need theater. We want theater to make us stretch.
Exactly. I mean, theater, it's just a place of life, and it's a place of spontaneity, and it happens, and it lives right in front of you. Anything can live in front of you in theater.
I think the demand you made of the cast in Equus really worked. And that's, again, that's another one of those plays that it's one of my favorite plays, and it's one of those. When we go to see our, what I call our icon shows, we just hope they're great, and when we walk out, we're, wow. You know, really says a lot.
Well, thanks. That cast was wonderful. Everybody worked really hard in that cast. Everybody from Kurt Ehrman, who played Dysart, and Jeff Button, who played Alan, and then even the chorus of Horses. Just
yes.
Everybody,
yes.
Everybody was so committed to that project. It was so wonderful to work on.
You did win a couple of awards for that, didn't you?
Yeah, I won a Jeff Citation for that. Yeah, for director. It was very nice.
And I remember when you got your award, you were wearing the wings.
Yeah, I've been, for the past 3 years at the Jeffs, I've been wearing wings. I don't know why. I can't explain it. I don't know.
But
why.
Now let me ask you this. Since wings are so a part of Angels, are we going to see you in wings on Sunday?
You probably won't see me in wings, but you will be seeing wings. So.
Yes, we will. Again, let's talk about where you're going as a director and as a playwright and set designer. I mean, you kind of do all three. Which one are you, by the way? If I woke you up in the morning and says you are,
I would probably have to say, you know, out of those three, I would say a director, because that seems to be where most of the attention of my life is focused. But I really enjoy playwriting. And set designing, it's ridiculous for me to even call myself a set designer, because, I mean, there are just really talented set designers in the city that actually know what they're doing. Like, the only way I can design sets is because it's an extension of my directing. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yes,
it's like,
it does make sense.
So I couldn't really design sets for somebody else very effectively, I feel like. There's a certain amount of skill sets that people have that extremely talented set designers in this city have.
Yes, there are. What about directing your own plays?
I'm really excited. I'm going to direct a play I wrote For the side project, and it opens in May, right after the second Angels opens. I'm going right into rehearsals for a play I wrote. So I'm real excited.
Which is?
Well, it's called Porno.
I wonder what that's about.
It's about a man who is trying to make a pornographic version of Christopher Marlowe's Dido, Queen of Carthage.
That sounds interesting. And in that little space.
Yeah, they moved. So it's basically the same size space, but now they have a lobby as well. So they moved down the street a little bit.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. I haven't been over there in a while, but yeah. They do some creative things there.
Oh, I love those guys. I mean, I love them. They just really, I don't think there's another group like them in the city that takes chances with such, you know, being so small and intimate and making such wonderfully strange script choices. So
I have to ask you about 448.
Okay. What about it?
Well, for me, it was a stretch. I don't know that I get her stuff. But I'll tell you what you did with the staging in that. I think you superseded what she was trying to do. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. Superseded. Wow. She is a wonderfully talented playwright, or she was a wonderfully talented playwright, and left behind some beautiful, beautifully painful, aggressive plays. And that's all. And this one is one of her most, I felt, one of her most brutal and one of her most, her saddest and most honest plays. And she was really trying to achieve, I believe she was trying to achieve a sense of honesty through a theatrical event with this piece.
Well, I think that the way you did it, you had the audience didn't sit. You had us standing and walking around. You had three basic sets, and you did some unique things with it. I thought it was quite creative. I thought you got a lot out of a work that was a bit troubled, but I think everyone was glad. I really kind of didn't like the story much, but I was enchanted with what you did, and I left with a message. I mean, so, you know, I can say that I was glad I saw a play that I maybe didn't like, but I'm glad I was there in a strange way.
Thanks. Yeah, it's. I just think it's a really unique play, and I think it demanded a really unique setup. Steppenwolf was asking us how we were going to arrange the seats for the garage, and it sort of came down to the deadline. And to do research on this play, I was starting to read a lot of Artaud, because she had mentioned that she was, she basically wrote these really aggressive plays that people said were very similar to Theater of Cruelty, the Theater of Cruelty that Artaud proposed. But she had never read Artaud. And so when she finally read Artaud, she wrote Crave, and then she wrote 448 after reading Artaud. So it's very much inspired by Artaud's principles. And there are lines in 448 that come right from poetry from Artaud. So I was reading a lot up on Theater of Cruelty, like the theater and its double, and he proposed that the action happens around, that the audience is in the middle of the action, that the line is abolished between performer and audience. And I thought that was I thought it was great, and I thought that it was very fitting for this piece.
And it works so well because, you know, I like to read audiences, and in this, I kept moving around, and it was as much the reaction of how, you know, their body language and how they moved around and how they followed it. And it was funny. Some people were sort of following the story, and some people were retreating from it. And it was – so that was as much the blocking. You were actually blocking the audience. I don't know if you were aware of that. I saw you at the opening night. Were you observing – how we were reacting?
Oh, yeah, completely, and especially after, like, I don't know, we had, like, 8 previews, so I was more nervous about how people were going to react to it. It was very personally, like, I felt that script demanded even more emotional commitment from me than I had given, so I really pushed myself to put a lot of myself and my insecurities and my fears in that show.
You sound like you're very proud of that piece.
I'm not proud.
Well, or satisfied?
I loved it. It was just a way of working that I had not worked before, and I worked with just amazing actors, and we all stretched ourselves and challenged ourselves. And
sure,
I really loved working in that way, and I'd love to do another piece like that.
All right. Well, let me put you on the spot now.
Okay.
And of all the plays you've done, tell me, it's an unfair question to say your favorite, because
okay,
most directors will say the current play they're in.
Oh.
Because they, you know, the old theory of each one, I get a little bit better.
Right. But I actually always hate
the plays at this time. You know, we open on Sunday, and I'm like, it's absolutely one of the most important plays ever written. Angels in America is, and it's, but I'm sick of it. Right.
So sick of it.
That's quite amazing. Now, I've talked to Walter Stearns, and he goes and gets a malted milk on opening night, on opening day. He will not sit there on opening day. What do you do? What's your ritual? Everybody has a special ritual.
For opening day?
Yeah.
We usually have to finish up a lot of the set stuff. So we do that, and then, you know, we do the show. I give everybody oranges.
You give everyone oranges. But, I mean, do you watch the opening night performance?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Because
yeah.
There are some directors who don't.
Yeah, they're crazy. Well, I'm crazy too. No, it's just what you want. I don't know. It's real important to me to see how people are enjoying it, you know, how people are receiving it.
But now, tell me some of the shows you're most proudest of, now that they're over. We won't talk about Angels in America in terms of that until you're satisfied that we like it,
right,
or you get the feedback from the audiences.
My favorite show, I would say, that I've done so far is Machinal, which we did in winter 2003.
Yes, it was the first one of your plays I saw. I was blown away by it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I would say that's the show I'm most proudest of.
Why?
Why? Because I think that it clarified a lot of what I was doing. In my head, what I had felt like I had been doing for like the past 4 or 5 years, and watching that show live in its final stages, I was like, yeah, that's sort of what I've been fighting for. So it's been helped me define my goal. And I thought working with Michelle Moe, who played the lead in that, was just an amazing experience, because I mean, we just both pushed each other to the absolute limits of what we could take.
She's not only a great actress, but she's also, isn't she the managing director of The Hypocrites?
That's correct, yeah, yeah.
So you kind of got her locked in, I would say. By now.
Well, she's got me locked in as much as I got her locked in, that's for sure. She's been around since the beginning, so it's our company. You know, it's all of our, of course, the whole ensemble, but I mean, Michelle and I have just been around together since the beginning.
After that's your masterpiece so far. All right, now give me the next couple of shows that are.
Okay. I don't know. You know, Jiminy Christmas. I liked 448. I certainly liked 448. I can't even think. I like Leon Sinlina. I thought that was a lot of fun. It was way too long, though. God, it was like over 2 hours for a stupid comedy. It was insane. I love that playwright. That playwright is great. And
you gonna do any more by it? Is who?
Buechner.
Buechner, right.
Well, we already did Wojtek when we first started, and then he only has one more play. So maybe someday we'll do that. Danton's Death. But
and a lot of people wondered if you could do the more mainstream plays. You know, they thought you might weird out Death of a Salesman or something, but you were very true to it, and I think you got everything out of it and, again, added those little touches.
Glass Menagerie and Death of a Salesman are weird plays. I mean, they're weird. They're wonderfully beautiful plays written, but they're not. People view them, you know, oh my gosh, where do I start? Anne Bogart has this wonderful theory about, like, why we're so fascinated with American realism, that it's associated with McCarthyism. And that's the time period that these plays were written in, where it was nobody in America was allowed to be sort of free of thought or a symbolist or anything like that. So Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams write these wonderful plays. You know, Arthur Miller, I think Death of a Salesman is inspired by, I would say, Expressionism more than anything. And Tennessee Williams says that his play is expressionistic. You know, it couldn't survive in production at that time being non-realistic. So I think the directors of the original productions, rightfully so, geared it towards what the audience wanted, and thus making them classics, you know, thus making them live for so long. But I think if you read the plays, which I'm sure many people have, but if you read the plays, they're not, there's nothing realistic about it. There's nothing, there's just, there's dreams, and there's projections, and asides, and hallucinations, and it's just, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful, so...
Well, now we see why you wanted to do those plays.
Yeah, I mean, they're great. They're just great plays, and they're so – people are just so used to thinking of them one way, but I don't think that the authors intended them that way.
Well, as I said before, the little touches you did with Death of a Salesman made all the difference. And not only me, I remember Chris Jones and Hedy Weiss absolutely loved the touches that you put on it too. And so, you know, you're getting – it must be fun that we kind of like your work, huh?
It's certainly nice, and I just don't – I just feel like it's going to not – I feel like it's going to stop soon. I just feel like I've been lucky, so I'm like really
– All right. What are some of the plays that you want to do in the next couple of years?
I would love to do Macbeth at some point soon, and that wouldn't be any rights issues. I actually – next year is our 10th anniversary season, so I put – sort of, in the company agreed, we put a lot of the plays that I've been dying to do for a really long time, Macbeth not being one of them, on that list of things to do. So I don't feel, unfortunately, I can't talk about it.
Okay. All right.
Just because I don't want to. I don't want to say we do it. We all sort of agreed until we send the checks in for the rights.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't talk about it. But really, next season's chock full of my dream plays for me.
Oh, your dream plays.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
I'm very excited.
So you're going to stretch again.
We'll see. We'll see. I don't know. I mean, definitely one of them is unlike anything we or I have done before. So,
could there be a musical on the horizon somewhere?
There could be a musical.
I'm not trying to connect the two.
Totally. Yes. There is the idea to do a musical next season.
We need to have more creative people in the non-equity field doing musicals. Because since Walter Stearns has moved up Porchlight to it as an equity house.
Oh, they're equity now?
Yeah. Yeah, they've been equity for a while. They do the minimum contract. But that's another question. Do you guys have any plans of maybe going equity?
We would like to. I think that I believe in labor unions. I believe in equity. And I think that actors should get paid well for their work. I wish that we could pay a living wage to everybody. So we would like to. We just have, you know, we have a wish list of what we have to do with our cash when it comes in. And right now we really need to hire an executive director and someone who's just more in charge of our company, our business.
So you don't like the business end of it?
Oh, I hate it. I'm terrible at it. You know, Michelle does a wonderful job. She's great, but I'm just terrible at it. And
since you're an itinerant company, do you have any plans on getting your own space?
We would love to.
Let's see.
Hint, hint. Well, maybe some of the donors.
Totally.
You know, I you wonder, guys like you, I hope someone has put you in for one of those MacArthur grants, or what they call the genius grants.
Oh, that's nice. I don't know.
Mary Zimmerman got one.
Well, she certainly deserves one, and her career is, you know, has... Yeah, she has more notches on her belt than I do, and even when she was my age, she had done a lot more. So,
that's nice company to be in, though.
Well, I'm not yet. I'm not.
Somebody in at Steppenwolf or Chicago Shakespeare or the Goodman, you know, needs to give you an opportunity to direct. Would you like to direct a major play in one of those places?
Yes, of course. I would love to. Absolutely. I mean, my relationship that I have with those people, the people at larger theaters are great, and I would love to work with them, work with their ensembles. Of course. Of course. Like, who wouldn't?
Have you done any directing outside of The Hypocrites or other shows?
Yeah, a little bit. I directed a show at Bailiwick, here at Bailiwick, last year. And
that's right. I'm trying to remember. Which one was that?
It's called References to Salvador Dali, Make Me Hot. And I've directed small things around for various people.
So that a couple people have asked me to ask you this question, and it's going to be a standard question for all my directors. How do you get those gigs? Do you... go to these theater groups? Do they put the word out, you know, when they're using outside direction?
It's, you know, it's different. This is the wonderful, wonderful and slightly detrimental thing about Chicago is that it's based on who you know and it's based on your friends, you know. No larger theater, not even smaller theaters, will hire me just because my name's in the paper. I mean, they have to get to know me. They just have to get to know me personally. It's not about necessarily the art, mm-hmm. Which is definitely a good thing. But it's so, I mean, just because I get a few good reviews or Jeff citations, it doesn't mean that, you know, all of a sudden next week I'll be at the Steppenwolf. It's their relationships that they cultivate and I cultivate, and it's just over time we just, you know, get to know each other a little bit more and see if that relationship can expand.
That makes sense. Sometimes I think some theater groups, they bring in a director because they know that director can do that kind of show. So, you know, so if they sort of think you could do a show, do you then get approached? Have you been approached for people saying, we think you're the right guy to do this kind of show?
I have been, yeah. I have been.
Oh, that's good. That means that. So it isn't the directors going out and, you know, like pitching a show.
It's that as well.
Oh, okay. So it's, all right. Well, I love your honesty. We're getting near the end of this podcast, and I want to talk a little bit more about Angels in America, and I am so looking forward to it. You know, the buzz on the street is this is really going to be something special.
I believe
that everybody from the A-list of the critics are coming. And you got to be excited.
It's definitely, I tell you, this play is very, really, really influential, and it really affected, you know, theater as we know it now, and sort of inspired it. It just revitalized theater, from what I understand it, and like it really changed the way people thought about playwriting. It changed the way that people view theater in terms of a little bit of American realism. It really inspired a lot of playwrights to push themselves into more graphic material, to show a side that hadn't been seen a lot. In
plus, you're blending three stories in one.
Oh my God, there's a million stories.
At least three stories, yes.
There's too many stories.
Well, it's at Bailiwick. It opens March 5th. It runs Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I believe it's 7:30, but go to the Bailiwick Repertory's website and you'll have the information, or you can go to on our Talk Theater in Chicago. We have it listed on the site. So, you are excited, and it's this one is opening the 5th. When is part 2 opening?
April, the beginning of April.
Sometime in the beginning of April. Well, we'll have it posted. So
April 6th is the first.
April 6th, we're hearing from the background. It'll open
April. I believe April 9th is the first
now,
opening.
I think each play stands on its own, and serious theater goers should see each one. But, you know, I think it's effective to see it almost a second time in repertory. There are days you're going to do part 1 and part 2 on the same day. Is that correct?
Yes, we're Saturday starting in April. We're going to be doing part 1 and part 2 in rep.
Now, these are long plays, but boy, I'll tell you, when you get through, it'll be like you were with the angels for a day.
Yeah, it will be an experience. It'll be a long experience, but I hope a rewarding one for people.
Is this the toughest play for you to put on in terms of, because it's a long, very complicated play?
It's had its own challenges. I mean, every play has its own challenges. Keeping the story in mind is a huge challenge with this because of the length and the scope of this play.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Sean Graney, thank you very much for a very honest interview. You know, a lot of people are looking forward to this, so folks, enjoy.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
So there you have it, another enticing and honest Talk Theater in Chicago's podcast. I'm Dustin Moat, but before you go, it's time for your Shakespearean quote of the week. The following quote comes from Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Thank you for sticking around for this great and honest podcast. Remember, every Monday we have an exciting, electrifying, intensifying, you name it, type of podcast coming at you. So check back to Talk Theater in Chicago every week. Until then, I'm Dustin Moat, reminding you to go see a play this week.